Our guest today has a dire prediction. He says that if poaching rates continue as they are today, elephants will disappear completely from Africa by 2025.
Mike Bond joins us now. He's a novelist, war and human rights correspondent, and the author of The Last Savannah. Mike has lived and worked in many remote, war-torn regions of the world and has spent time fighting elephant poachers in Africa. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you very much. It's a delight to be here on Central Time.
Well, there's been some big news in the U.S. in the past several months having to do with the ivory trade and the destruction of this country's ivory stockpile of seized ivory. Can you catch us up on the latest?
Well, about a year ago, it became clear. I mean, it's always been clear, but it started to make international noise that the elephants were just disappearing at an astonishing rate in Africa. They're being slaughtered at an astonishing rate. And it's taken a while to galvanize this opinion, but where we stand now, because let me back up a bit, if I might. We're about 1970, we had 10 million elephants in Africa, more or less. As of today, they're down to 400,000, including both the forest elephant and the savanna elephant. And they're being killed at the rate of over 100 a day. So given the increase in the poaching rate, the 2025 date as the complete elimination of elephants in Africa seems very likely. And lately in the last few months, it's just as you were beginning to get into, we had had some movement. We've had, first of all, the European Union, 28 nations, came out with a whole series of resolutions that ivory trade and or the trade of blood ivory, if you wish, illegal ivory, is a criminal offense. They're trying to make that stick in all 28 countries now. The UN has similarly come out with a resolution basically saying the same thing, and, of course, the deal now is to get member countries to accept the resolution. There's been a lot of international meetings. Hillary Clinton was very strong on putting together a group of people to try to reach out to the governments of all of the African nations and get some coordination to cut back on the slaughter. And just more recently, the Obama administration has basically, through what's called an administrative action, has attempted to halt all ivory, blood ivory transactions in the United States, i.e. either importing into the United States, selling within the United States, or exporting out. And the problem with that is that it requires a diligent involvement of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in inventorying cargoes coming into the United States and going out. And that is being substantially impaired by the sequestration in the government, whereby there's cutting back of funds so that right now Fish and Wildlife has insufficient agents to do the job. So in that sense, you could argue that the Obama administration's action will not have a lot of impact.
So, Mike, we want to talk about those efforts to stop the trade and to stop poaching and who those poachers are. But let's go back to that issue of the destruction of the ivory stockpile. Why is that important? And is there any reason not to destroy all of that ivory?
It's important. It's a two-edged sword. You can look at it. I believe it's very important. It has to be emphasized. What happened in 1990, the CITES, international agreements on suppressing ivory trading, they did allow countries to keep some stocks. And so there's always been a gray line between what's a stock, what supposedly was legally culled, as if you could legally kill an elephant. And then they slowly, for financial reasons, filter that back out into the market, and the market is incredibly, right now the market, the ivory market is the hottest it's ever been. The prices in China have gone up 5,000 times, 5,000%, which is 50 times in the last 10 years. So the idea of the crushing them or the burning them is to remove them from the potential of being traded. And also it's a statement. It's a statement that this is illegal, and the same way I suppose that you might burn, I don't know what you do with it, but you might somehow destroy a cargo of heroin.
But couldn't it be argued that by taking that stockpile out of potential circulation that you're actually making ivory that much more valuable for the poachers?
definitely you could argue that, but it's part of it's part of an international condemnation. And France has done it, the United States has done it, Kenya has done it, a couple of other African nations have. I believe Great Britain is about to, even China, in a kind of a publicity move, crushed or burned, I forget which, a small amount. You could argue that, but the situation is more that we just have to, the only way the elephants are going to survive is if we absolutely remove from human consciousness the idea that ivory is something that should be sold, bought, or made into something. We have to remove this option from human awareness. Otherwise, the elephants are toast.
You mentioned that the price of ivory in China was going through the roof, so obviously there's demand there. Where does the U.S. fit into that picture? How big is the demand here?
Well, the demand here is huge. We are the second largest. The United States is the second largest importer of blood ivory after China. And that's why the Obama administration's move is a very good one. As I said, it's going to be very difficult to implement because there's a whole underground market for ivory even in the United States. I've been told, I haven't checked this out, but there are more than 10,000 blood ivory sites selling ivory on Google. And that kind of thing is extremely difficult to track down and to in any way override.
What do people want ivory for?
Well, in many Asian cultures, not only China, but Thailand as well, Indochina to some degree, certainly Japan, for many, many centuries, ivory has been a cult kind of status thing. If you were wealthy and you had a certain amount of status, you proved it by purchasing ivory, which either if you were very wealthy, you would purchase an ornate ivory sculpture. And I've seen things like ivory thrones and made of hundreds, not hundreds, but many different tusks, all carved and intricately put together. And so it's a huge status symbol in these countries, again, particularly in China, to have ivory. It shows that you're wealthy and that you're kind of in touch with Chinese are very methodical about how they pursue their culture, if you wish. And what's happened over the last 20 or 30 years is, in my opinion, U.S. politicians and corporations have worked a concerted thing to remove jobs from the United States and send them to China. Chinese people, as we all know, have gotten comparatively rich, a lot of them. There's just millions of people in China who a generation ago were impoverished, and they now have millions or many hundreds of thousands of dollars all come from, or mostly from, the U.S. economy. And so that's what's fueling this enormous demand, is this incredible growth of wealth in China. And the problem is, too, that on the African end, it's now the poaching is not any longer done by a bunch of guys in a village with a couple of guns. These are either parts of some African armies that are doing it, or they're highly coordinated poachers that are connected to terrorist groups like Al-Shabaab, which is the people that are linked to Al-Qaeda, who shot up that marvelous shopping center in Nairobi a few months ago.
So, Mike, you have spent time in Africa fighting those poachers that you just talked about. What is it like on the ground working to save the elephants from those poachers?
Oh, it's terrifying. And I haven't done anywhere near as much as some guys have. But you're out there. What we did is we were out in the bush in Kenya one time. I'll give you an example. We out in the bush and you just patrol. And because the savanna is very wide, you can hear gunshots a long way off. So we're out in the bush and just patrolling, looking for vehicle tracks, anything that would give us a clue that we might have some poachers nearby. And you can hear the gunshots 4 or 5 miles away. So you leap in your Jeep and you race in that direction, 3 or 4 Jeeps with rangers who are poorly armed and making maybe $2 a day. And then you have to go into the jungle because the savanna, what it is, as we all know, it's a mixture of grassland, rolling grassland, and forested areas. So you end up having to head into a forested or dangerous area looking for people who are waiting to shoot you. So in that regard, it's a very terrifying thing. In addition, in Africa, when you're out in the bush like that, so many other things that are dangerous. You could step in a little to the wrong way, and the Gabon viper bites you in the leg, and you get a minute to live. Or there might be a hungry lioness that is waiting to pick off the person who's the most isolated from the rest of the team. So it's a very spooky thing.
We're talking right now with Mike Bond. He's a novelist and war and human rights correspondent. He's also spent time fighting poachers in Africa, as we're hearing about, and he turned that into a novel, those experiences, called The Last Savannah.
And we'd like to have you join the conversation. Do you think America has done enough to combat elephant poaching? Are you worried we could live in a world without wild elephants in Africa? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking about recent efforts by the United States to curb the ivory trade and protect endangered elephants in Africa. Mike Bond is with us now, and he wrote a novel about fighting poachers in Africa. It was based on his real-life experience there.
And you can join in. Do you think this should be a priority for the United States and other Western countries? Should we be combating elephant poaching, and how? And are you worried about what a world without wild elephants in Africa would be like? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And let's go to the phones and Alex in Stoughton. Hi, Alex.
Hi there.
Hi.
My question for Mr. Bond is how far we're willing to go in terms of removing the idea of poaching from the human consciousness. I feel like we enter into sort of dangerous territory when we're trying to, you know, make people not think about that. We'd almost have to start censoring scenes from classic works of literature like Moby Dick, where they capture whales in order to obtain these ivory. And, you know, in order to remove that as part of the human experience, I think would be sort of dangerous. So how far are we willing to go in that endeavor? And then what are some sort of positive ways that we can encourage people not to poach? And if there are some, why haven't they been effective in the past?
Thanks for that call, Alex. Mike, would you like to respond?
Yeah, that's a very good series of questions. And I think you're absolutely right. This is not an attempt to engineer changes in consciousness. This is, and in fact, my book, The Last Savannah, there's several passages in it involving poaching, and it write down on the ground how it really happens and what goes on and what you're left with. So I believe absolutely, and my goal is that we make these things more evident as part of what I call literature as revolution. My whole purpose is to make things known, and the idea being that if you can tell the truth, then we can change. So I think what we have to do is just make people aware that this isn't a negative thing. This is like child molestation or some other horrendous thing. It's a form of behavior that we need to alter. And the only part that we can really alter is the consciousness of whether or not a person should purchase ivory, because the people who are out there shooting the elephants on the ground, we can't reach them. It's war right now. It's like Syria. And so we're not going to be able to negotiate a change with them. We have to make all humans aware of what this terrible tragedy is. And that's why I wrote the book. I wrote The Last Savannah to put the reader actually on the ground in Africa. It's extremely vivid. I'm close to all the animals, and I bring the animals to the reader and the different tribes and languages and the histories and myths all to the reader. And so I'm trying to create such an exciting and unforgettable memory. It's as if the person had been there, and that's how I think we should change. And to the part of your question referring to what can we do, one of the best things to do is to simply join the World Wildlife Fund. They have done an absolutely amazing job at trying to internationalize and broadcast this issue. And they have folks in Africa, like I was, who are risking their lives on a daily basis trying to put a stop to this.
Mike, I want to ask you mentioned that you wanted to tell people the truth, that what really happened on the ground when an elephant is slaughtered. And it might be difficult to hear, you know, sitting here removed so far from Africa and what you saw, but I wonder if you could tell us what does happen.
Well, what happens is, in some cases now, the poachers, particularly those with military regimes that are doing part of the poaching, they are now locating elephants sometimes by air. And because the elephants, as I remember when I was young, that a group of elephants, a herd of elephants, could be 3 miles wide and 10 miles long, and they would be migrating down from the mountains in north central Kenya down toward the wetter southern part of Kenya, and it was huge. And now there are little outposts of elephants hidden in the bush wherever they can, terrified of the guns. So it's getting harder and harder to find them because there's fewer and fewer. But so they're up there. They, one way or the other, these guys track down a bunch of elephants, and usually it's a small herd, again, for the reasons I said. And they simply go in, and the first thing they do is they try to shoot all the big elephants so that they're, so the big ones don't represent a danger. And they're usually using AK-47, so it means a number of bullets. Sometimes a whole magazine goes into one elephant. It takes a long time for an elephant to die in great pain from being shot with an AK-47. And then they mop up, i.e. they kill the smaller elephants, may not even have any tusks, but they'll even kill a baby because the baby is standing by its mother crying, not understanding why the mother is dead. So it's and then they just go in with a chainsaw or with an axe, and they chop off the tusks and throw them in the back of a pickup truck, and off they go. And it goes from there. The tusks go to a village where they're trucked eventually to a port, where they're put in a big container that's labeled furniture or pineapples or something, and off they go to China.
Yeah, that is incredibly hard to hear, but thank you for telling us what you saw.
And you said that if current poaching rates continue, you predict an Africa without elephants by 2025. That's really pretty devastating and very close time-wise. Do you think there's any way at this point that we can avoid a future like that?
I think there's two really important things we could do. And one is that the developed nations, which have in general more organized armed forces, there needs to be an international armed force that is sent to Africa with the whole purpose of fighting the poachers. Could be a United Nations force, fighting the poachers and interdicting the transport of blood ivory. That would be one thing. We need boots on the ground. And I can think of, I have many friends in the U.S. Marines, and every single one of them says that that would be the best training that young Marines could have, is to be out there on the ground hunting down the poachers. I mean, it's war. It's a guerrilla war. And so that's one thing. And the second thing I think is really important, isn't being done yet, isn't even being talked about, but should be done, is some kind of a boycott on Chinese goods. The Chinese have so completely devastated our economy, and they are the major environmental criminal, if you wish. They pollute everything. They pollute the air. They pollute the waters. They overfish everywhere. They have absolutely no environmental consciousness. And so as far as the Chinese government is concerned, they've made a couple of window dressing moves, but they're not doing anything significant to even advertise that blood ivory is got to be stopped. A lot of the Chinese people think that tusks fall off elephants as they do off a deer, for instance, and as an antler falls off a deer. So the second really important thing that could be done is a worldwide or at least a U.S. boycott on Chinese goods.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got a lot of folks waiting to talk to you, and go to Larry in Kewaskum. Hi, Larry.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, I'm a piano technician, and I have bags of ivory from keytops that I've recovered with plastic. And I have a grand piano in my living room with an absolutely perfect ivory keyboard. It was built in 1938. Is this going to endanger the elephant? I mean, I don't know if this ivory is worth anything, but I'm a member of the Sierra Club, so I don't want to, you know, sell this ivory to for.
Yeah, this is a good point. It's
all
a
right,
series
thanks,
of good points, Larry. My wife is a pianist also, and we have several pianos with ivory keys. I never asked her whether there's a difference in playing it between the ivory and the plastic. Larry, what do you feel about that?
Oh, there definitely is a difference. Yes, it wicks away the
perspiration.
You know,
yeah.
Well, I have no knowledge as to how much those keys that you have, the extra ones, might be worth. But at this point, as I understand the Obama administration's action, it's now illegal for you to try to sell those.
Okay, so he should what? Hand them over to the government?
I'd say just keep them. Keep them, you know,
keep
because
them.
Sooner or later they're going to become valuable to replace on other old pianos. I mean, most of the new pianos, I believe, are being manufactured without ivory keys. Am I correct about that, Larry?
Well, that's my question. If ivory is going to be so desirable for, let's say, antique pianos, wouldn't that increase the reason for elephants to be slaughtered?
Right, so Larry's not wanting to create demand there. And I want to stop there so we can have a last question with you, Mike. I just want to, if you wanted to urge people to care about this, I wonder if you could leave us with one of the elephants, a story about one of the elephants you got close to in our last 30 seconds here.
Okay, well, you just go to the book for lots of elephant stories, The Last Savannah, or my website, mikebondbooks.com, has lots of elephant stories. But one of the nicest ones we remember is just being in camp at night, my wife and I and the three kids under mosquito nets on cots, and a whole herd of elephants moving through the camp and moving right around our cots and sometimes sticking out their trunks to give us a sniff. It was a lovely feeling of connection.
Well, Mike, thank you so much for joining us and for talking about this today.
Well, thank you for covering this. It's a really important issue, and it's typical of WPR to be involved with this. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Appreciate that. Mike Bond is a novelist, a war and human rights correspondent, and a human rights activist. He's the author of the new novel, The Last Savannah. It's drawn from his real-life experiences fighting poachers in Africa.